This program is a presentation of UCTV for educational and non-commercial use only.
See if I can repeat the question for all of you, and I don't want to do violence to the question. What do you think the framers would think of a system that has created a presidency in which the president can take an American citizen on American soil and essentially toss him in jail and deny him the kinds of constitutional rights that we've assumed are the rights of any American citizen? I think they would be of mixed opinion because don't forget the alien and sedition laws were signed by John Adams within a few years after the Republic was founded, and they were about as anti-constitutional and anti-civil liberties and anti-individual liberties as anything, and it was John Adams of all things. I mean, one of the nation's founders, the guy that wrote the Massachusetts Constitution, who was the president that signed that outrageous bill. What would they think of taking 120,000 Japanese Americans, most of them citizens, and putting them in concentration camps? And it was FDR who did that. What would they think of telling Asian Americans that they couldn't own property ever? That happened in this state. What would they think of an Earl Warren? Remember him? Who was one of the great liberal chief justices of the United States and campaigned on an anti-Japanese American, put him in camps platform in 1942 against an incumbent Democratic governor and beat him. Because, as he said, when you looked into the eyes of a Jap, you couldn't tell what he was thinking. Oh, Warren. So, this is needless to say not to excuse the present president and his administration. I think what they're doing is outrageous. And I hope that that institution that we rely on to correct these injustices will act, especially the Supreme Court of the United States. One of whose members is a guy named Scalia, who was a classmate of mine at Harvard Law School in 1960. Even then, he was to the right of Marie Antoinette. Now, let's see what. So we've had, you know, not to mention segregation itself and the kind of institutionalized racism, which was part and parcel. Institutionalized racism. Look, folks. At the time that the American Constitution was drafted and ratified, a great document though it was, only about 10 to 15% of the residents of the United States were enfranchised. Ladies, you had no political rights. People of color, with very rare exceptions, no political rights. I remember hitchhiking through Mississippi back in my youth in the 50s. I think there were a total of 335 black voters in the state of Mississippi, and every one of them deserved the Congressional Medal of Honor for what they had to go through to get the vote. I mean, let's not romanticize the past here. Now, that does not excuse the present. So my hope is that the Supreme Court of the United States, including Scalia, will stand up and say, look, this is just totally inconsistent with the Constitution. But that's the institution, ultimately, that we rely on when there is what you and I guess, would call an abuse of executive authority. And yet, go back to the Japanese relocation stuff. Went to the Supreme Court of the United States, Hugo Black, Jackson, Douglas, and they approved it. They said the president had this authority to take American citizens, give them 72 hours, put them in trucks, and ship them off to concentration camps. Folks, if you haven't been, Kitty and I had the great experience of visiting the Japanese American National Museum in Los Angeles. Go to Los Angeles, put it at the top of your list. Walk through that place. Spend a few hours looking at that. So we say we believe in our Constitution and individual rights. Oftentimes we don't, and we hope the system will work, and I hope it will work this time. So far, at least at the district court level, we seem to be getting judges who, I guess you and I would say, understand the Constitution and are prepared to stop this president or a Democratic president, for that matter, from abusing his authority. Whatever I do has a lot to do with this great lady to whom I'm married and who I love dearly, and I don't know what you'd say about foregoing our winters in California for service to the nation. But if John wins, and if I can be helpful, particularly in two areas that I feel very strong about, one is health care and 44 million uninsured Americans that don't have a dime of health insurance, and the other, of course, is this transportation thing, I'll try the best I can to serve, and it's really going to be up to him to decide. Fortunately, the president does have a lot of authority in that area. But sure, I'd love to make a contribution in some way, but I hope he can win. I think he'll be a great president, and if he is, and I can make a contribution, I'll do it. I don't think it'll be on a full-time basis, but that my bride and I will have to discuss. Now, what's happening? I'll try to keep this as brief as I can. For reasons I don't understand, folks, and I'm not here to beat up the media. I've got a daughter who's the NPR reporter in Denver, for those of you who listen to Andrea Dukakis from time to time on NPR. That's our kid. Very proud of her. She's based in Denver, and she reports from Denver. And some of my best friends are in the media. But the national media still can't cover a presidential primary. Instead of getting off their collective fannies and going out to Iowa and going to New Hampshire and knocking on 50 doors and talking to real people, they spend millions and millions of dollars doing what? Taking polls. These polls in primary and caucus states aren't worth a plug nickel, as we've seen, right, over and over and over again. However, they're very dangerous for the candidates. Poor Howard Dean. He was the front runner, right? There is no front runner in these races. There's no front runner until average Americans walk out of their houses and down the street and either go to a caucus or a polling place and vote. And poor Dean became the front runner. Why? Because the polls said he was the front runner. Pity the poor front runner. If I had a nickel for every hour we spent talking to national reporters about why I was not the front runner, ever, you know, I'd be a millionaire. That's the last thing in the world. I'm a little worried about Kerry. All of a sudden, he's the front runner. Remember, he was the front runner. Based on what? So they have a very distorting effect, I think, on what's going on, and they tell you nothing. The fact of the matter is that a large percentage of folks in the primary states are undecided. Trust me, a third of the New Hampshire voters who are going to vote on Tuesday still haven't made a final decision on what they're going to do. Not because they don't have the courage of their convictions, they're looking at these candidates. They're just seeing them for the first time. Now, I hope and I believe that John will do well in New Hampshire. He's got to do well in New Hampshire. But then it's South Carolina, it's Oklahoma, it's North Dakota, it's Arizona, it's California. And I think you guys at last are going to play an important role on the 4th of March, along with New York and Massachusetts and a number of other states. And that's as it should be. So I can't possibly give you a prediction, except to say that I'm pleased that my guy, who as usual started slow and then kind of kicked it into gear and started doing, he does this every time, now seems to have hit his stride, and people are really seeing the John Kerry that I know and respect and support. People say to me, well, you know, who's his running mate going to be? The first thing he's got to do is get elected. On the other hand, if you were to say to me, what's my dream ticket? It's Kerry Edwards. And that's the ticket the White House doesn't want to run against. Is there going to be a contest? Believe me, there's going to be a contest. This president, the only poll that I'm interested in is the poll on Bush, because he's now a known quantity. Bush is in the low 40s on re-election. The low 40s. An incumbent in the low 40s on re-election is in deep trouble. Doesn't mean he's going to lose. He's going to have a gazillion dollars. And I expect the attack campaign to begin shortly against my guy if he runs things. And this time, we better have a candidate, unlike the guy you're looking at, who's ready for the attack campaign. But I think John and a good running mate, I think Edwards would be a terrific running mate. And I'm not putting him down. He's running for president. He's not running for vice president. I think it'd be a great ticket. And I think this is going to be a real contest. But at this point, we've had only one contest. Kerry has done very well, and I'm pleased with that. I hope he does well in New Hampshire. But those two states ought to be good states for Kerry. The question is, what happens after that? And that's when you're really tested. In my case, don't want to go on a great length. In my case, I did a respectable third in Iowa. Not great, but a respectable third. I won in New Hampshire. I had to. I was the only New Englander. I won the Minnesota caucuses. I lost in South Dakota. I did fairly well on Super Tuesday. I did win Florida and Texas, but I didn't win a majority of the Super Tuesday states. And I went to Illinois, and I got creamed. 7% of the vote in Illinois, and I got beaten in Michigan when I was way ahead in the polls. Jesse beat me. And I then recovered in Wisconsin, and by that time, fortunately, some of my friends and colleagues were running for the nomination and began dropping off, and so it was Jesse and Al Gore and me in New York, and I won there and pretty much locked up the nomination in New York. So it's a long, tough, grinding race. And then, as I discovered, much to my dismay, it's a whole different campaign in the final, which I really didn't understand as well as I should have. So this is, I mean, we really put our candidates, folks. This is not a five-week British parliamentary election. I mean, this is tough. And you're at it month after month after month. It's the toughest thing anybody in politics ever has to do.
So. Tell us if in the Bill Clinton speech at your nominating convention, I mean, was that a factor? What ultimately happened to you?
No. As many of you know, Clinton made a very long speech. And it wasn't his fault. We looked at it. We approved it. It just turned out that it was too long. And when he announced in November of 91, George, he went on the Johnny Carson show. And Carson said, "Why are you running?" He said, I want to finish my speech for Dukakis. But it didn't get in his way. No, you know, the big lesson of 88 is the other guy's going to come at you with an attack campaign, folks. And unfortunately, that's become... It's not only become part of American politics, it was part of American politics when people were attacking Jefferson and for a variety of things, including his personal life. I mean, it's just that TV makes it even tougher. You got to be ready for it, and you got to have a very carefully thought-out strategy for not only blunting the attacks, but if possible, turning them into a character issue on the guy that's doing it. And I just utterly failed to do so. I don't think any Democrat since 1988 has made that mistake, and I certainly don't think Kerry will. Yes. Unequivocally, yes. Look, the Electoral College was another one of these profoundly anti-democratic institutions that was created by the framers of the Constitution, great though they were, because they distrusted average people. They didn't trust even this limited electorate to vote for president. The only thing they would do is give them the right to elect folks like them, that is the framers, to make the decision for them, right? Now, that gradually changed, in the early 1800s, Jacksonian democracy, who says we can't vote, and so on and so forth. But the institution remains. You know who the most recent president was who made a serious effort to abolish the Electoral College? By the way, he was one of the more recent presidents who advocated universal health insurance. He was a Californian. What was his name? Richard Milhouse Nixon. And the abolition of the Electoral College passed the House about 330-60, or whatever the breakdown was. But it couldn't get through the Senate because, well, folks in the southern states who in those days, in many cases, supported institutionalized racism, did not want the college abolished. And the small states don't want it abolished. But it's absurd. I mean, we're all Americans these days. And I don't care whether it's a half a million for my guy or the other guy. The fact of the matter is that in every other, as you point out, every other election we have, a majority vote controls. And in this case, it didn't. So, I think it's long past time we should abolish the Electoral College.
I just want to make a quick parenthetical on Gary Wills' new book on the Negro president about Thomas Jefferson. Every slave counted for 3/5 of a vote. Slaves could not vote, but if you had 200 or 300 slaves, each one of them counted for 3/5 of a vote, which is why Thomas Jefferson was able to defeat Aaron Burr. One of those kind of remarkable little-known things about our history that we have tended to overlook because we have so sanctified our past. That's my comment. Yes, the gentleman, last question, the gentleman from the chamber.
Look, it is not true that you... Pete Wilson, doesn't he come from here? Inherited a huge deficit from George Duke Majan. Not knocking Duke Majan. I mean, we were good friends, even though we were on other side, on opposite sides of the aisle. And Wilson raised taxes by, $7-8 billion, basically. He said, we got to do it. He also scooped a lot of money from the locals. You know, if you did that in Massachusetts, you'd be assassinated. I mean, Schwarzenegger's trying to do it as well. Reagan did as well. And, Reagan had committed himself to not raising taxes. He said, my feet are fixed in concrete on that issue. And then, of course, he raised taxes. And some reporter said to him, what happened to that commitment of yours? He said, the sound you now hear is the concrete breaking around my feet. And remarkably, both of them survived. Now, look, you folks have got to decide whether you're going to borrow your way out of this and pay twice as much over the course of that bond issue, or whether you're going to insist that the folks you elect, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, stand up and say, we're going to pay for this. I mean, you've got a great university system, folks. It has everything to do with the future of this state. Are you going to pay for it or aren't you? Why do you think you get all this high-tech and biotech stuff around here? It's UC San Diego, isn't it? Or am I missing something? And I just got to tell you, I've been defeated in part because I raised taxes my first term. But what's the point of getting elected if you're not going to stand up and try to do the right thing? And you've had lots of people in this state who have stood up and tried to do the right thing. So there we are. Now, you're with the chamber? All right, I want you to take this message back to the California Chamber of Commerce. Sorry to do this, because I feel very strongly about this. I'll try to keep this very brief, George, but I had to get this in. The legislature passed something called SB2, which is going to require, over time, all employers with 50 or more employees to insure their employees and their families. It's nowhere near what you ought to have, but at least 1.5 million uninsured working people and their families will be insured. Today, 70% of the employers in this state insure, roughly. And well over a simple majority of small businesses insure. When their competitor down the street doesn't insure and his employees end up in the emergency room, that cost is transferred to them. Which means that if all or most employers were required to insure their employees, these employers would not be paying not only for their own employees, but for the guy that's competing against them. Question, what is the California Chamber of Commerce doing opposing SB2? They ought to be supporting it. I don't get it. They don't even understand what's in their own self-interest. I don't get it. I just don't understand it. And in the meantime, either responsible employers who do insure or you as taxpayers, because you're paying a huge Medi-Cal bill for this, are getting tagged with it, and it has a lot to do with the fiscal crisis you find yourselves in. So, for whatever it's worth, I don't want to get you fired. Will you go back and tell them that this outlander from the East doesn't understand why the employer community in the state, or at least a substantial majority of them, don't understand what's in their own self-interest? I mean, I would take it down to 25 or more employees, and you can fill in the gaps. But to continue to tolerate a situation where a majority of your employers do insure and are not only paying high premiums, but premiums that are high in part because the cost of free care is being shifted to them by people that are competing against them. It's crazy. And I don't get it. Sorry about that.
It's okay.
Brief peroration.
He's actually with the regional San Diego chamber, but
so. Yeah, but they're part of the chamber, aren't they? I mean, I don't know where they're. Anyway, no. I won't bring me back, and I'll give you my speech on health insurance.
We're going to close by making a presentation, and then I want the governor to share a story with us related to this. This is a photograph of the governor in 1988. With number one, it's a Red Sox jersey down in Florida. This picture appeared in Sports Illustrated when I was staying with the governor and Mrs. Dukakis during the Yankee Red Sox playoff. I asked him if he had this picture. He said he didn't. So I called the editor of Sports Illustrated, and a very good guy. And this is the picture. And it says spring training, Boston Red Sox 1998, and still number one. 2004. Now, Governor, you tell them the story.
Thanks, George. This is terrific.
Did you get that, Mark? We'll just step over here. Here we go.
Where do we hang this, sweetie? Someplace. This one we may have to take back to Boston.
Okay.
Right?
All right.
Campaigning can be hard, but there are a million laughs, and it's a lot of fun at times. And in the 88 campaign, Super Tuesday, I think, was in the middle of March, and Florida, of course, was important. And we knew it was important. But I said to my staff, I said, look, whatever you do with me in Florida, just one thing. I want to go to spring training. At that time, it was at Winter Haven, and spend 2 or 3 hours with my favorite baseball team. I've never done it. You know, the dream of every Boston kid is to go to spring training. And you never can because you're in school and all. What do you mean? We got a million things we got you to got to have you do, this, that, and the other thing. So I said, look, I've been campaigning nonstop since April. I'm sorry. I want to go to spring training. So set it up, 8 o'clock in the morning, whenever they start, and give me a couple of hours so at least I can, a lot of grouse. And I said, and by the way, you know, there are a lot of people in this country that like baseball. Who knows? You know, we might get a little ink out of this. Anyway, with great, great reluctance, they arranged for this. And I arrived in Winter Haven, and this gorgeous Florida morning. I mean, not a cloud in the sky. It was about 80 degrees, and I'm talking to Yastrzemski and all these guys. And John McNamara was the manager at the time, and he came up to me and he said, you want to hit? Now, I hadn't touched, you know, I played a lot of ball. I was a catcher, and I played a lot of ball as a kid, but I said, yeah, sure, why not? Now, in the meantime, folks, the stands are full of people, all these snowbirds who come down from New England, and some of them actually have condos down there. I don't know what happened when they moved from Winter Haven to Fort Myers. I think a lot of these people had to sell their condos and stuff. Now they're down in Fort Myers. And they're all in the stands. I mean, it wasn't a game. It was just practice. And so I took off my jacket, and they gave me this shirt with a one on the back of it, a Red Sox shirt, and I grabbed a bat, and I went up to the plate. Bill Fisher was a pitching coach at the time. He was throwing batting practice. And there was some guy who I assume was a Republican from New Hampshire in the stands who, in a very loud voice, said, that guy couldn't hit a giraffe in the ass with a bass fiddle. Fortunately, despite the fact that I hadn't swung a bat in a long time, I hit the ball pretty well, and it was pretty obvious to the crowd that you know, at some point in my life, I had played a fair amount of baseball, and so I got 10 pitches, and I think I hit 9 of them, And so, you know, to the applause of the stands, I walked off. And of course, as I left the plate, went over to the side, I was surrounded by all these folks, reporters and other people. And of course, it was national TV. Not only that, but the inside front page of Sports Illustrated. The following week, I got a full-page color photograph of this guy with a one on his back. And I called my staff, and I said, you guys probably don't even know what Sports Illustrated is, but will you go down and buy yourself 20 of them? I just got you about $5 million worth of publicity. I later found out that Dick Gebhardt, who was also campaigning in Florida at the time, and Al Lang Field in St. Petersburg is the Cardinal, it's the Cardinal farm team, but that's where they do their spring training. He berated his staff. He said, look at this. Dukakis' staff has enough sense to send him, you know, to his spring training, and you know, he gets all this press. And why did you guys think of this? I talked to Dick yesterday, and you know, commiserated with him because he's a good guy and, you know, he's taken a real hit here. I did not have the heart, George, needless to say, to tell him about this spring training thing. Someday when, you know, the pain of loss is faded and we're just kind of kidding around, I'm going to tell him that it had nothing to do with my staff who did everything they could to stop me from going there. It was yours truly who insisted that. But I'm going to treasure this. This was a wonderful moment in that campaign. Thanks, George.
Let me let me just close by again thanking Cal Western and thank you so much, and our appreciation to Dean Smith and to all of you and to the partnership and to the chamber. And this has been a great moment. I think you can sense now why those of us who have the honor and privilege of his friendship and of Kitty's and the families of the family, why we love this man. This is an exceptional person, wonderful, wonderful public servant. And when you leave, I want you to think about this. He didn't need to do this. He just didn't. But he said, "Can I help?" I said, "I think you can." That's why he's here. And now I think it's appropriate, in the best San Diego tradition, to express our appreciation to the great Mike Dukakis.